College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. Now here's your host, Kevin Nagandi.
It's hump day, and thanks for joining us. Appreciate the support from our listeners, and if you like this podcast, you can subscribe, rate, and review. Ahead, Ivan Mazel joining us with much more on Ryan Helinski, the impressive quarterback from South Carolina who lost his brother, former Washington State quarterback Tyler Helinski, to suicide last year. Ryan will face Alabama this weekend, and Ivan wrote a powerful profile on Ryan and his family. But first, as he does every single Wednesday here on the podcast, David Pollock joining us here. And David, I want to get your initial thoughts on what you saw in Austin. That was, of course, the biggest game of the weekend, LSU-Texas. Go.
You know, it was interesting because right before the half, first of all, Texas left some serious opportunities on the board early. You know, having first and goal inside the five twice and getting 0 points out of it, I thought was a huge blow early. And then going in the half, I thought LSU had this thing under control. They were playing pretty good defense at that point. The offense, you could tell, was really, really starting to click. But I was impressed. I was impressed with LSU just like everybody else and Joe Burrow and the offense. And the most crazy thing I saw, Kevin, is if you talk to any coach in America, for God's sakes, America, all across America, and you talk about a four-minute offense, when I'm on offense, a four-minute offense consists of there's 4 minutes left in the game. I have to get a couple first downs, run out the clock, and put the women and children to bed and go looking for dinner, okay? Mm-hmm. That's the goal. That's the goal of a four-minute offense. That means run the football. That means be very conservative. LSU's in shotgun throwing the football left and right.
Fearless.
If you needed any indication of turning the page to being a different team and to being a more aggressive team and a more offensive team and a more pass-happy team, that's all you needed to see. And then Joe Burrow on 3rd and 17, I mean, my God, you talk about making magic. It was beautiful. Stepping up the pocket, covering the ball with both hands, blitzing, getting hit in the face, throwing the ball down the field for a strike for a first down, touchdown, ball game over. But just, I was blown away by LSU's offensive passing game and the mindset in which they had coming into the game and closing the game.
All right, I'm fascinated by this too. Burrow's Heisman odds went from 25-1 down to 6-1. Is this an overreaction to what we just saw? Or is this an accurate assessment of where he is right now?
I think it's an accurate assessment of where he is right now. And it might be, Kevin, somewhere in between, but he just threw for 471. Like, I mean,
yeah.
That's a good day at the office and a
very good day
in a hostile atmosphere. And listen, I know Texas's defense is nothing spectacular, but you know, I saw enough to know that his offense is going to be really good. And remember, Georgia Southern, we kind of brushed aside and, you know, we didn't really think too much about Georgia Southern, but it was still a 5-touchdown day and a super efficient day. This is back-to-back, you know, high completion percentage, high touchdown passes. And I think you're going to continue to see that. Stats matter. And then we're going to see the big tilt with Alabama, you know, a little bit later in the season. That's going to carry a ton of weight. And if you can do that against that kind of team, you know, he's going to be in it. But I think he'll be one of the top five guys mentioned here on out for the rest of the season.
Okay. But you mentioned Texas defense and one of the, you know, after the game, one of the things I saw out there, and you know how Twitter can be Twitter, and somebody's like, he didn't really do anything because it was against the Big 12 defense. I want to see what he can do against the SEC. And I was like, oh, okay, this is how you're going to play it? Like, it's not his fault that he's facing Texas, and he's doing this on the road. And like you mentioned, the 3rd and 17, they were just fearless. How do you judge this LSU offense against the Big 12 defense?
I'm not saying it's a huge measuring stick, and obviously there'll be bigger challenges down the road. But let's be honest, too. I'm getting a little bit annoyed with this because is Texas an LSU defense, or is LSU a SEC defense?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, they just got lit up by Texas.
Exactly.
Right? They just got obliterated by Sam Ehlinger, right? So I think we're a little bit. I think the SEC defense and is a little bit. It's overblown. I'm tired of talking about, like, the SEC defense is so much better than, you know, look at the Rose Bowl a couple years ago with Baker Mayfield. How many did they score? 40 plus?
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's not like they haven't been getting theirs. And, hey, did Clemson do okay against the Alabama SEC defense last year in the championship game? They did okay, right?
Yeah, they did.
So I think this is something that – I think this is something that translates. Are there going to be better players that they're going to face? Yeah, sure, there is going to be. But I think this is not going anywhere. I think this is here to stay. I think LSU's offense will be good all season long, and it will be largely due – now, listen, what will define this offense in being really great is if LSU's run game is going to be good enough, because I don't see enough in their run game right now. I don't think they're good enough on the offensive line. And they got some guys that are going to be coming back from suspension, and they should get, and a guy that should get healthy that could change them up front possibly. But up front, I think they're much better pass blockers than they are run blockers. So I think you're going to continue to see throw the ball all over the yard.
Could you ever imagine saying that out loud, what you just said? When you're talking about the deficiencies in the running game, trying to meet the level of LSU's passing attack?
Yeah. No, it's definitely
So how do you view this offense?
It's a different system.
Tell me what you think about this system.
Well, it's so different. Like most offenses nowadays, when you watch college football, they're basically – to compare it to basketball, they're basically like the Warriors. Most offenses, their threes are dunks, right? Mm-hmm. It's that there's no intermediate passing game. Now this is different. Like Joe Brady, you can tell it's more of an NFL influence. They're throwing drive routes left and right, and he was taking advantage of the intermediate game, which is very, very hard to stop with good timing. You know what I mean, that's the hardest thing, is when a quarterback can throw before a guy breaks, and you got a wide receiver streaking down the field fast, looking like he's running a go, stacks his foot on the ground and makes a cut and stops. It makes things very difficult. So I think this offense is a little bit different than most because it does attack that intermediate range. It's going to stress you deep. It's going to stress you short, and it's going to stress you in the middle. So it's kind of interesting to watch and interesting to watch develop. As LSU fans are going to like it.
I like it, and I can't wait to see how this plays out the rest of the season as it gets better. And there is hope. We're not saying that LSU's running attack is good as gone. They're just young. So give it time and see. Let's see how it develops, because they're going to need that backfield to grind out some games later on the schedule here. We'll be back in a minute with more from Pollock. But first, a word from Allstate. Because mayhem on Saturdays in the fall is inevitable. Mayhem happens on the field, off the field, and in the polls. Mayhem lives on the wind, in the rain, on the foot of an errant kick, and during a trap game. You'll find mayhem in the parking lot, during tailgates, charcoal that's not totally out, an errant football through a window, a flat tire, a lost side view mirror, etc. You get the point. Allstate protects you from mayhem in the parking lot and outside it, at home and away. You can't stop mayhem from happening, but you can get better protected from it with Allstate. The potential for mayhem during the playoff race is rampant. Underdogs, trap games, unexpected weather, etc., etc., etc. Get better protected from mayhem with Allstate. Contact your local Allstate agent today. You pour through a ton of film during the week, and on Wednesday, it's a great opportunity here to kind of open things up for us. What did you notice in the film room this week when you were watching tape of week two?
One of the things I really wanted to see was Nebraska. I mean, I think that was one thing that, obviously we saw the collapse, but to me it's like, why? You know, what's the, especially to come out the gates so blazing hot and then the offense to be shut down. And Nebraska offensively, what I saw was a team that does a lot. And, you know, you're talking about Martinez. First of all, let's talk about Adrian Martinez. Really good athlete. Great arm talent. Can throw the football all over the yard. And their offense is super difficult to defend because they're doing everything. I mean, they're doing RPOs. They're doing drop back passes. They're doing option. They do tempo. So, you know, you think about all these different systems across the country that just do RPOs and that just do option and that just, that just live in the RPO world or the option world or the drop back passing world. Well, when you do one, you know what happens, Kevin? You really master it. You know, you really start to get a grasp of who you are and what you are. They do so much stuff, and then they add tempo in, that there's just so much to process. And I don't think anybody in the country has more on their plate than Adrian Martinez. To do all that stuff, to do it with shifts, to do it with motions, and now have to read defenses, you know, I think his mechanics suffer a little bit from that. And I think what you're going to have is you're going to have some ups and downs. And it's going to be very tough to be consistent when they do all that. I'll just be interested to watch Nebraska's offense morph and to see if it becomes more of one world than three or four worlds right now that they're trying to exist in. Because I think once they started getting, once they started struggling, they didn't have an answer of something, Kevin, that mm-hmm. they could really depend on. Like, this is what we do well. We're going to do this no matter what and be successful. And you see that at Clemson. You see that at Washington State with Leach. You know exactly what you're going to get. I think you see that at LSU. They're going to be a pass-first team. Like, what is this team going to morph into and what is the style going to be? I think Scott Frost is still finding that out. And I think that's why Nebraska lost last week.
Okay, with that, what does Adrian Martinez do so well? What's his best attribute in this offense?
Well, he does a lot of things. He does a lot of things really well. But his ability to run and as a passer, to threaten you as a runner and a thrower is really, really good. I mean, he's phenomenal at that. He's not the most physically imposing guy, but he's got a slipperiness about, is that a word, by
yeah.
the way? Slipperiness?
Yeah, yes.
He's got this
it's your word.
Elusiveness about him. Yeah, I mean, listen, I'm a defensive player, bro. We've been hitting the head a lot, okay? he's just got this ability to kind of slither off people and make plays because he's kind of built low to the ground and powerful. And, you know, I would live in the world if I was them. I would live in the RPO world because I think it's easier to make decisions, and you can rep the same play and read a different guy, and you can stay in that world so easy, and it can be such a clearly defined thing, but it's not going to be something that's done overnight. It's going to be something that's going to have to be repped ad nauseum, i.e., if you want to see something, by the way, Justin Fields, same way. What he is right now is not half of what he's going to be at the end of the season if he continues to grow in his reads and still understand what he's seeing. But if I ask Justin Fields to be a drop-back passer for the next couple weeks or in practice on Monday and Tuesday, and I ask him to do seven or ten different things, Kevin, how do I truly expect him to be great in one world when I'm doing 50,000 things? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
I'm trying to break it down to something that makes sense, but it's also part of Scott Frost that makes him such a genius.
Okay.
And that dude's he's an animal.
It does make sense, especially when you take a look at what UCF turned into and how they relied on the quarterback. But how do you view then the help around Martinez, like a Maurice Washington in the backfield, and his options at wide receiver, with Spielman out there, you have Robinson. How do you view the help around him?
I think he has pretty good help, and I wasn't sure about that until I went and watched the Colorado game, but I think he has a lot on his plate for sure. But I also think that when you start going through his backs, I think his back is solid. I think he's good. I think he's very talented. I think the slot receivers are really good, and they're great fits for this offense that can do multiple purpose things. You know, that can do multifacets, that can read different things. You can spit it out to him on the perimeter, let him do some damage. You can attack the middle of the field. Those slot receivers and tailback, those are the spots that when I was watching, I was going, oh, 28, good back. Oh, 10 in the slot, really good. 1 in the slot, really good. I mean, I think there's some complementary pieces around. I will say this too, Kevin. I don't think the line's solid. I don't think it's a top-notch offensive line by any stretch of the imagination. And I think it's very green. I don't think they communicate exceptionally well yet together. I think they'll grow and continue to as they start together to get better chemistry. They're not maulers, and they're not physically dominating players. I think they could be a decent unit by the end of the season. But I think Martinez has help around him, and I think the line will get better, and I think the weapons will click more. And I think by the end of the season, they're going to be, really in stride and really, really good. Just right now, I think they're going to be a little bit up and down.
Now, so you're watching tape here. You're watching Nebraska on one side, but we brought it up briefly last week. How about Colorado? What did you see from Colorado, a team in the Pac-12? And I think Mel Tucker's done a fantastic job.
Have you ever heard Mel Tucker talk?
Yes.
Like, have you ever spent any extended period of time with him?
Not as much as you, but I've heard him talk.
I mean, Mel just don't play. Like, Mel is an awesome dude, and Mel lays out his expectations exceptionally well, and he does not mince words. He expects a lot of things from you and will demand a lot of things from him. Now, one thing I think it needs to be stated, Mel Tucker did a phenomenal job. They did a phenomenal job with defensive adjustments, and I love what they did. But the first thing that sticks out to me is Jay Johnson in the offense. I think they have an amazing understanding of what they want to do and who they are. I think he's a stud. I think he's a star in the making. I think Mel showed some, and Jay together showed some serious cojones too. When you're down 24-7, backed up on your 5-yard line or 3-yard line, whatever it was, and you do a flea flicker, bro. Like, yep. What part of you thinks that's a great idea? That's disaster waiting to happen. That's literally you getting crucified by everybody in your media. How can you do that and take a safety? You know what I'm saying?
Like, it is. It is a classic. It's a classic. You're yelling at your TV like, no, what the heck? Yes. You know, as that play develops. But here's the thing. How Nebraska was viewing it too. Like, there's no way they're going to open the playbook here. They're going to go conservative. And I thought it was a fantastic play by KD Nixon. And if you watch the film, from the one end zone, once the ball was thrown, Montez, who threw the ball, knew they were going for a big score because of the way Nebraska had that protection and that defense. They knew they had an opening.
And there's a couple of different thoughts to black zone. So y'all hear red zone all the time, yeah, right? Red zone is when the offense is going in. Well, black zone is when the offense is coming out. And there's a couple of different thought processes. A lot of teams, when you watch games on Saturday, watch guys, you'll see it. A lot of teams, they take shots in the black zone. Instead of just because they take deep shots, they play action and try to go deep and hit a big play. Because everybody knows the other side of that coin is the other thing you're going to get. You're not going to get the perimeter run game because people are scared to get outside. You're not going to get very many bubbles. You're going to get run the ball up the middle, buy me some space so my quarterback's not in his own end zone. Or you get quickly take a shot down the field. Quickly play action, turn your head, quickly catch in the shotgun, take shots deep so I can buy myself possibly a little bit of space. Flea flickers aren't involved in that, okay? That's not something that's discussed. And another thing too, Montez, by the way, he's one of the most talented passers in the country. He really does. He gets on hot streaks where I'm like, man, this dude is fire. Like, he is really, really good. I think him and Jay Johnson, Laviska Shenault at wide receiver, this group could be really, really special by the end of the season and be a group that wouldn't be fun to play. Wouldn't want to be fun to play.
Yeah. At the end of the month, well, at least next week, they got Arizona State on the road. They're at Oregon as well.
Yeah, which will be fun.
At Utah at the end of the season. They host Washington and they host SC. So they got their work cut out for them. But they really impressed me in that environment. When I say environment, it's a home game, but Nebraska traveled quite well for that contest to Boulder. And if you look at the top bowl, you saw a lot of red. That's just because the Huskers and their fan base are fantastic in that region. And for me, you know, you score on that big play, the place is rocking, it's now a 3-point game, and then Nebraska responds immediately with Washington, that 75-yard run off the pass. And now, again, all the air's out of that building once, if you're Colorado, in a matter of 13 seconds, because it was just one play, boom, boom, boom. For them to come back and the way they won this game, it shows so much, I think, resiliency for Mel Tucker early on in the season. They got Air Force, which is coming off a bye. We'll see how that plays out. What I like about this with you and talking to you on Wednesdays is you notice some things in the film room. Now, point out to us some guys, some studs that soon will be on our radar that you're watching on film.
So I turn on Ohio State's defense, and you start watching along the defensive line, and there's dudes everywhere. We've consistently watched them over the years, but you're watching 9 inside, and you're watching 54, and the most important name to know is number 2, Chase Young. Like, he's the guy that, he's the straw that stirs the drink. Kevin, he'll probably be, if he's not the number 1 pick in the draft, he'll be the number 2 or the number 3 pick.
Yes.
I mean, he's gonna be that kind of high. That
depends
that's what
who,
kind of
on who needs a quarterback
has
in the top then, part of the draft, right? Like, because usually it's not
correct,
the best player.
Yeah.
It's always the quarterback taken. Like we saw in this last draft with Kyler Murray over Bosa.
Yeah, and who wants Tua?
Yeah.
You know, that's probably going to be the debate. I think Justin Herbert's not going to be the first quarterback taken. I don't see that happening. But I'm watching Chase Young, and he's an animal. Like, just he's got a repertoire of moves. It's really, really sensational. And then I don't think you see him until play 8, literally in the game. and you get, and you see this kid, and you're like, ooh, okay. 11. He's in a nice stance, comes off the ball, has a little shake. They try to cut him, and he's an athlete. I'm like, all right, well, you know, guys that play cut blocks usually, you know, there's a lot of guys that can play cut blocks. How big are they? You know, and then you look up his height and weight, and he's 6'4". He's like 260. And then I start watching a little bit more, and I'm like, dude, like Chase Young is the super freak on one side. And this, I look up his name is Tyreek Smith, and he's from Cleveland, Ohio. And I'm like, Lord have mercy. Cause you saw Bosa and you saw him leave and you see Chase Young. And now I'm going, this cat right here, Tyreek Smith, has a chance to be special. I mean, 6'4", 260, but you know, playing cut blocks and faking in, faking out with it, using his hands, having some pretty good hands when it came to pass rush. And I was just like, how this is just unbelievable. Like Ohio State, just where do they continue to find these guys that are just super freaks and great athletes? And I promise you, down the road, in order for Ohio State to win a championship or get in that conversation, Tyreek Smith's going to have something to do about it. And he's number 11, and he plays opposite Chase Young, so he won't get as much attention as Chase, and will have more opportunities to make plays. But if not this year, he's the breakout guy. Next year, you're going to see this guy, and you're going to see plenty of him. So yeah. Ohio State just kind of, they'll find another guy and put him in there, and no big deal.
He was a stud out of Cleveland. And if you look up some information about him, true freshman a year ago, saw a lot of time last year, and it just shows if you're a true freshman and you're in the defensive line rotation at Ohio State, you're a stud, right? And we've seen him play.
Yeah, he's pretty good.
And he's got speed. Like you said, he can play basketball as well. He was a superstar in high school in basketball, 6'4", 267 pounds. How, can you imagine that guy in the lane if you're playing basketball coming in and he could do anything he wants inside?
That wouldn't be fun. That wouldn't be fun.
Yeah, and it just shows you the strength that the Buckeyes have. They lose a guy, another guy comes right in, and he stands out. And Chase Young is on one side, and good luck on the other side. And that gets to here. We had a nice conversation during one of our halftime shows on ABC with Mark Sanchez and Jonathan Velbon. Who's going to win the Big Ten East, right? And all the talk about, of course, Ohio State, Michigan. You could throw in potentially Michigan State. I'm curious to see what they do against Arizona State this weekend. Penn State, of course. We'll talk about
them. Did you watch their offense last week, though?
Listen, D'Antonio's
You just gave me the yeah.
He lit a fire with his boys, and you had a lot of fun with that. But I think we're going to learn a little bit more against Arizona State, right? Especially what we saw from last year and how they lost that game. This game's in East Lansing. And then let's go into, you know, Maryland. And I want to get your early thoughts on what you saw from Maryland's offense.
Oh, boy. Dude, that was – first of all, I'm Syracuse. Wow, I still haven't recovered from that spanking. It's just amazing what happens. First of all, Maryland, over the years, there's been so many playmakers, and there's been so much speed. Like, you've seen those guys. I mean, you're going, how did that guy go to Maryland? How did that guy – I mean, just playmakers. But you always saw consistently no quarterback play. Josh Jackson comes in at the perfect time. Perfect time. Obviously, listen, Anthony McFarland, I think Junior, is the guy that makes this go. Like, if you watch him, he ran a little speed out and caught the ball into the sideline and literally makes a guy miss and goes 40 before you can blink. Mm-hmm. I mean, just has the ability to make the sensational plays and the big time play. And you've seen some of that over the years. You saw him last year go for over 200 versus Ohio State. One thing they never had was good quarterback play. Never had a guy that could drop back and throw it. Well, now you got it. Josh Jackson transfers over from Virginia Tech, and you just see him spin and bean. The RPO game, the same thing you've seen from Alabama the last couple years. Locksley now coming from Bama in that world. After failing, by the way, he's already got as many wins as he had at New Mexico. Like, literally, in his coaching career. So, but a guy that talks about learning from his mistakes and a guy that can use playmakers. And I love the way he rolls the pocket with Josh Jackson. I love the way he gets the ball out quick sometimes and takes shots and hits the screen game and isolates playmakers and gets him the ball in space. It's just, he does a great job. And just what an unbelievable coup for him to get Josh Jackson. You could tell this offense is for real. And Maryland's going to be dynamic, and they're going to be a lot of fun to watch.
142 points so far the first two games. And then they got Temple this weekend, which I can't wait to see.
Say that again. Just two games.
Yeah, just two games.
Just two games.
And then Temple this weekend, and then Penn State.
It's unbelievable.
So We'll see them tested in the Keystone State with those two teams. We're going to celebrate, and we've been doing this so far early in the season, the 150 years of college football. We're going to celebrate all season long here at ESPN. There's going to be a lot of lists coming out. And earlier this week, ESPN set out to rank the 150 greatest college football single season teams of all time. It's a panel of 150 media members, athletic administrators, and former players and coaches. They looked at 210 finalists. And I wanted to get your thoughts on the teams that you grew up watching, on the teams that in the last part of this century that have dominated, because number one is the 1971 Nebraska team. I'm not expecting you to know anything about Johnny Rogers.
I think they are number one, by the way.
They are, yes.
Just to be clear.
Oh, you do? You think they deserve to be number one?
I know I wasn't born in that era.
Yeah.
And I know, listen, we can't. Kevin, it's impossible to compare now's players to those players. The systems have all changed,
yes.
And the players have gotten bigger and stronger. And listen, I know a team right now would wipe that team out off the face
of
the earth.
Well, it's the Chamberlain,
about bodies,
it's the Chamberlain, Michael Jordan, LeBron debate, right? It's just different eras, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
It's a different era, different time. But one of the things that holds true is a resume. And who you beat along the way. Clemson last year gets a lot of love, right, for their finish. I mean, they spank Notre Dame's Heine,
yep.
Spank Alabama's Heine. So they immediately go from to one of the greatest teams of all time. Well, the regular season, they didn't really play a great schedule at all. How about this? How about that Cornhuskers team? And, again, this is stuff I've read, guys. I didn't watch 71 Cornhuskers, okay? But you're talking about a team that played the number 2, 3, and 4 teams in the country and beat all of them. They beat Oklahoma, they beat Colorado, and they beat
Alabama.
Else they beat Oklahoma, Colorado,
Alabama.
And Alabama.
Yep.
They beat all three of those teams that finished 2, 3, and 4. 10 of their 13 games, they didn't give up more than 7 points. I mean, in a game. So, I just, when you start looking at that, and I know they beat the number 17th team in the country as well in that season, that matters to me a lot. So I give the immediate edge and the immediate win to 71 Nebraska, because I can see that you, when you play great teams, I can see that, and I'm going to reward you for that.
Pollock 100%. With the history lesson. I appreciate that. I want to get your thoughts, though, at number 2, 2004 USC, Pete Carroll. And then we've got the 95 Nebraska team coming in 4th, the 2018 Clemson team. You just talked about that. The 2005 Texas team with Mack Brown and Vince Young. The 2001 Miami team, which I am so high on, to me and with my own eyes, is the best team I've ever seen. The 2009
Alabama
team.
Are you high
Alabama
on them because
team.
Of those guys and what they did in college? Or are you high on those guys because those big names that went on to the NFL and just lit up the NFL?
No,
well?
It's because what they did in college. I lived in Florida at the time, so I was in the hotbed of covering Florida, Florida State, and Miami. And I was at that 2001 game where Miami was at Florida State, and Florida State had a ridiculous winning streak at home coming in. And that Miami team and that defense looked so dominant. I was 26 years old at the time, and
unreal.
I looked at that defense, and I was like, that defense may be good enough to play on Sundays. That entire defense. And that's how loaded they were. They literally
they all
were
did.
Stacked with, you know, the Ed Reeds of the world, the Jonathan Velmas, every single level you looked. And again, like, they had 38 guys drafted. And a ton of first round yeah. picks. To me, that team was unstoppable that season. How do you view it? How do you view?
I got you.
You know, team and these other teams.
I'm with you on that. And I completely agree with what you're saying. Who was the quarterback of that team?
Philip Dorsey.
Ken Dorsey?
Ken Dorsey. Philip Dorsey. What did I say?
Ken Dorsey.
Ken.
That's his brother. Yeah.
Yeah.
No big deal. That to me, Ken Dorsey was always one of those guys that didn't mess it up.
Yep.
But never set the world on fire, but he had so many weapons that made him look good. So when I start looking at that team and versus, you're talking about now versus Leinart and Bush. Oof. Cause don't forget, they had dudes on defense now too. I mean, remember their linebacker core for a solid 25 years there. I mean, a solid stretch there with Pete Carroll. I mean, they would smack you in the mouth. The wide receivers were game changers, big physical guys that made Leinart look good. And Reggie Bush, is there a more explosive, dynamic playmaker to touch the ball on offense? I mean, Barry Sanders, maybe?
Yeah.
You know, like he's
in the
elite
game.
Company,
yes, in the college game.
You know, of his own too. Oh, yeah. So it just, you know, I would compare those two teams right there. And then you got the Vince Young team that, you know, remember Vince Young's touching the ball every time. And was he not the most fun player to watch in college football history when he had the ball? Him and Mike Vick and some of those guys, they just made magic happen. It was crazy. So it's impossible to measure, but if I'm going to start nitpicking about teams and the greatness of those teams, we got to concentrate a little bit too on who touches the ball every play at quarterback. To me, that would make maybe the difference between some of those teams.
Oh, is that why you asked me about Ken Dorsey, who was the quarterback?
Correct. That's exactly why I asked you.
Okay.
I knew the answer. I wasn't asking you because I didn't know. I was asking you because that was the guy that touches the football every time. And, you know, I know, listen, he was handing off to Clinton Portis and Najee Davenport was a backup for God's sakes.
Frank Gore back there as well. But don't forget
Dorsey won
the Maxwell Award. Don't forget that year. Like he won the Maxwell Award
because of what he had around him. No, he won the Maxwell Award because of what he had around him, bro. Let's be honest. Okay. Let's call a spade a spade.
Well, listen,
I loved him and he's a winner. He's not even close to another caliber of guy like Vince Young or guys like
you would have to think that Dorsey was pretty darn good considering he had to face his own defense on a daily basis at practice.
He had his freaks on offense.
Yeah.
He had his guys on offense. Just hand it off to him and then play action and throw it to him. It's pretty good.
All right, Pollock, we're going to wrap this up. You're coming back, of course, on Friday. We're going to take a look. It's not a sexy schedule when we talk about games, but I have a sneaky feeling that we're going to see a couple of tight games because that's just college football, and we're going to have you join us on Friday to take a look at the Week 3 matchups.
Appreciate it, my man.
We'll be back in a minute with Ivan Maisel, but first, a word from Goodyear. Sometimes for inspiration, you just have to look up. For more than 60 years, the Goodyear blimp has fueled greatness on the gridiron by providing aerial coverage of some of the most legendary moments in college football history. When the Goodyear blimp rises above a stadium, it inspires players to reach higher and rise to the challenge of the game's biggest moments. Now it's your turn to go further with Goodyear. Discover tires made to rise above the rest. Learn more at Goodyear.com. Goodyear, more driven. And it's great to have Ivan Maisel join us now here on the College Football Podcast. Ivan, you wrote a powerful piece on freshman Ryan Helinski, South Carolina's new starting quarterback. First college game, 282 yards, 3 total touchdowns, played about 3 quarters in a win over Charleston Southern. It really wasn't what he did on the field, though. It's all the things and the emotions built into this debut. It's life afterwards. Ryan's playing for his brother Tyler, who died by suicide less than 3 weeks after Washington State's bowl game a year ago. His parents, Mark and Kim, they've moved to the area, Columbia. What did you learn about Ryan and his family while writing this story?
Well, my relationship with the Helinskis goes back to last year when I did a piece for Game Day and about Mark and Kim. And they are a very close family, Kevin, and they're still hurting. I mean, you know, Tyler has the wounds of Tyler's death are still pretty raw. And all I wanted to do, especially once Ryan became starting quarterback after Jake Bentley got hurt, was go down there and see how they experience Ryan actually playing. And they had not had a son play in a college football game since Tyler started that Holiday Bowl. And they were nice enough to take me in, and I spent the day with Mark and Kim and with the family. They had family come in literally from all over the country, from the Bay Area, from New England, from Miami, and they all were there to support Ryan and to support Mark and Kim and their oldest son, Kelly. And it's a strong family, but they have really been hit hard.
South Carolina faces Alabama this weekend, and Nick Saban praised Ryan after his debut. This story's on ESPN.com. Ivan Maisel writing this fantastic piece here. And how did Tyler's death change how they view Ryan? I mean, we're talking about a freshman quarterback playing in the SEC. And you mentioned this is the first time they're watching someone in their family play football after losing Tyler.
Well, if you're a parent, then you know your, you know, how you view the safety and health of your children. And they, Mark and Kim, are trying to, they're watching Ryan very closely, mm-hmm. because Tyler gave no sign that he was struggling. Nobody in the family knew anything about his struggles until it was too late. He didn't tell them. Tyler was a very outwardly upbeat guy. He made sure everybody around him was happy. Ryan has some of those same qualities. Ryan is a very mature 18-year-old. So when you see Ryan and you are around him, and this came from his coaches and from his teammates, he's very mature. You know, he reaches out to everybody. He carries himself like a much older guy. But when Mark and Kim see Ryan do that, they see some of Tyler. So then they naturally think, well, is this really Ryan being stable, or mm-hmm. are we seeing the same thing again? And it's just maddening and heartbreaking as a parent to know that they have to consider that. They have to think that way. In the end, Mark Helinski, Ryan's dad, said he thinks Ryan is more stable than he used to be. Part of that is age, and part of that is he's had to grow up really, really fast. He's had to grieve publicly the death of his older brother.
Can't imagine the mental and emotional mind games throughout this process over the last 18 months or so. Mark and Kim are strong advocates for mental health care for student athletes. How are they doing that? How are they trying to change things moving forward?
Kevin, they have poured a significant amount of energy and time and done a lot of fundraising for a foundation they began called Helinski's Hope, which is advocating and staging programs for student athletes to push them to take care of their mental health as well as their physical health, to explain to them that it's okay to be vulnerable. It's okay to seek help. And that's a message that especially big, strong football players don't get very much. And, you know, let's face it, mental health among young people it's a national crisis. And you add to that all the pressures and stereotypes that student athletes have to deal with. This is something that needs to be done, a task that needs to be taken on. And Helinski's Hope is trying to do that. And, in fact, they have gotten a lot of support from the Gamecock community. And a South Carolina fan, suggested that at the beginning of the third quarter Saturday against Alabama, everybody stand up and raise a three, which I take to mean everybody would stand up and raise three fingers. Maybe they'll have a number three. I don't know. But it's a nice gesture. And, again, it's to raise awareness for this crisis.
And the young man, Tyler, wore the jersey number three, and that's what Ryan wears, right, to honor his brother,
yes,
number three? And it seems trivial to talk about football and make this a serious event here this weekend as South Carolina takes on Alabama, number two in the country. But how's Ryan processing things? You mentioned in the piece, you talk about it here on the podcast, his maturity. How does he approach football now?
Well, I think he understands that it's not the be-all and end-all of existence, which is sometimes a tough message to get across especially to an 18-year-old. Ryan's a really smart kid. He's a very accomplished quarterback. It's not mastered is not the right word, but his knowledge of the South Carolina offense, you wouldn't know he just enrolled in school there in January. against Charleston Southern, he didn't play flawlessly. He did throw one interception, but the offense was virtually flawless. They set a school record with 775 yards of total offense. They didn't commit a single penalty. He completed his first 12 passes. The offense didn't commit a single penalty. Ryan completed his first 12 passes. Eight of them, the first eight went to eight different receivers, which tells you he's disciplined mentally and he's going through his reads. And that's something pretty unusual for a kid that young. And now the Alabama defense might be a little stronger, faster, quicker,
just
smarter.
A little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. Than Charleston Southern. He's in for it Saturday, but he's not going into that game without any weapons.
One thing that that stood out as well in the profile, Mark and Kim are there to support their son, but you had mentioned Kelly, the oldest, who's 24. He also moved to the Columbia area after Ryan enrolled in January. What's behind the idea that this family is making sure Ryan has a support system around him there in Columbia?
Well, that's exactly what it is. And they are all creating support systems for one another. Kelly moved there. He just took the MCATs. He wants to go to medical school. He's got an apartment near Mark and Kim. And Ryan spends most nights in Kelly's apartment on a mattress on the floor, which is such an 18-year-old thing to do. And Kelly basically told me that you would think, I'm there, I'm 24, I'm there to mentor him, but he's also there. He's helping me. We're all helping each other as we try to get through the loss of Tyler. And Kelly and Tyler were really close. And what's been interesting to me about this is that Kelly and Ryan, even though at their ages, 24 and 18, that's a sizable gap at that time in your life, but they have become very, very close.
I love it. I have a 7-year-old brother, so I understand that gap in between and how you have some type of sibling rivalry, but it's not like if you're within 2 or 3 years of age. Like, you look at things differently, especially at somebody in their mid-20s to somebody who's 18 and in college and experiencing things completely different than, what Kelly would. I think the one thing that when you talk about Ryan as a kid, as an 18-year-old, he sounds amazing. But when you bring up the idea that he's sleeping on an air mattress, there are still a lot of other 18-year-old things he does, right? I mean, we don't want to make it sound like, and I'm not saying you are, but we don't want to make it sound like he is just this 18-year-old turning 39, right? I mean, he still does 18-year-old things, right?
Oh, yeah. No, he and the family, you can't hide from your family. And, Kelly got a frantic call Saturday morning. Ryan had gone down to be with the team Saturday morning for the noon kickoff. He had forgotten the polo shirt that everybody's supposed to wear for Gamecock Walk. So Kelly, drops what he's doing. He lives a half hour from the stadium and races down there. And Mark had said to me Friday, he fully expected to get a call, hey, do you have any size 13 cleats? there is some 18-year-old
that's
in there.
That's great.
No question.
That's great. We only wish him the best. The piece is on ESPN.com, released this morning, which is Wednesday. Looking forward to hearing his story and his journey and a follow-up against Alabama. Ivan, thank you for sharing what you saw when you covered Ryan Helinski and this family as they try to, put the pieces back together and understand after Tyler's abrupt death and moving forward and kind of finding a healing process on the football field by watching Ryan. Let's switch stories here and you know, there is no easy transition or natural segue when we talk about somebody resigning. But it's a huge storyline, especially when you talk about the history and the program and where they play in college football. And that is Lynn Swann resigning as USC's athletic director earlier this week. There was the writing on the wall, and there were rumors rampant that a firing was down the road. What was your first reaction when you hear that a change is going to be made with Lynn Swann stepping down after 3 years at USC?
Well, it was a curious hire to begin with. Lynn had no administrative experience, and to do that in this day and age, when college football is such a big business, and when we've seen the old model of a football coach retiring and, quote, moving upstairs to be athletic director is long gone. Barry Alvarez is a notable exception at Wisconsin. But Lynn hadn't even been a coach. He'd worked for us for a long time as a commentator. He worked at ABC. And he had run for governor in Pennsylvania. And then all of a sudden, okay, he's athletic director. Well, you think he's there as a fundraiser and a figurehead, but that's what it looked like anyway. But everything that an athletic director has to do now, it's so complicated and so difficult. And the problems that USC has had over the last 3 years, and there's a laundry list of them, really, they were crying out for somebody at the top that knew how to administer an athletic program. And Lynn was wanting there. USC's got a new president, Carol Folt, and she's been there not very long, but she waited until she felt it was the right time, and Lynn Swann is out the door.
Yeah, Folt, as you mentioned, was hired in March, and again, he came in 2016. He's a legend there at USC, and he replaced another guy who was a legend. That was Pat Hayden, who came in with no experience as an AD, but Pat had an idea of how to run a business, because like you mentioned, being an AD is a completely different thing than what it was 20 years ago. You're running a business, and we all know that. And when you see the struggles during his tenure now, they won. You can make a case they won five national championships with five different women's and men's sports. There's a strong side when you look at the GPA over the last 2 years, and the graduation rate, I think, is at like 86% last year, and it was at an all-time high for USC athletics. But you can't ignore one thing, and that is there's a scandal that was, surrounded that basketball program. And then when you look at the football team, coming off that losing season, the first one since 2000 at 5-7. Now they're 2-0, the Trojans, with Clay Helton, but there were a lot of pushback on what was going on in the direction of the football program and where it was going when it comes to big time sports here and where people identify with USC. When you look at this opening here and you look at the track history of what USC has done in the past, who should they target? And it's not even a specific name I'm asking for, Ivan. I'm asking, like, what should be part of the resume?
Well, let's try running an athletic department. You know, that would be a good start. There are, what's interesting, Kevin, is that USC, even though they have not hired a professional to run the athletic department in really since the 80s when Mike McGee was there, who recently just passed away, as a matter of fact, they've gone the route you mentioned. They've hired ex-USC football legends. Before Pat Hayden, it was Mike Garrett, the 1965 Heisman winner. Especially now, and they need an experienced administrator, by all accounts, and there are plenty out there that would love the opportunity to take on the mantle of USC, because, as you point out, it's a big program with a lot of resources, a tradition of success, a fan base and alumni base that just can't write enough checks. And, you know, there's a lot to like about that. You know, USC is rare in intercollegiate athletics because it is in a major metropolitan area, and yet it is thriving as an athletic department. If you look at so many schools and programs that are in NFL cities, they struggle for oxygen because the NFL and the other pro sports eat up a lot of dollars, advertising dollars, and time of fans. But USC has that fan base in LA, so it's a great opportunity.
And Ivan, you nailed it there when you talk about the NFL and you talk about cities. It is the only college football program that can be represented as a pro football program in that city, considering that they didn't have football in the NFL in LA for over a decade, and no one cared. No one cared about it because they had USC, no matter what. And you've covered that team in the Pete Carroll years. Matt Leiner and Reggie Bush, they were superstars. They were bigger than NFL stars in that town.
They really were. And, you know, you can have a long and interesting debate about whether that contributed to USC's downfall and the because they clearly the program was at rock star caliber a decade ago. It was really, you know, not that long ago. Well, you know, you say a decade's not that long ago. In athletic terms, it's a very long time. I mean, USC has won since Vince Young scored with 19 seconds to play. They haven't sniffed a national championship. They haven't played for a national championship, and that was 14 years ago. And since Pete Carroll left a decade ago, they've won one Pac-12 title. So things have changed, and they need football to get out and be the tip of the spear again.
Yeah, and they also need a new narrative, considering also, and I mentioned, you know, the scandal surrounding USC back in March. We cannot forget that multiple coaches and a USC senior associate AD were arrested for roles in that massive college admissions bribery scandal, which rocked everybody in the spring. And a coach and an administrator already admitted they took bribes to get students into the school, and they've pled guilty to racketeering conspiracy charges. This school and this athletic department needs a new direction, and it's going to be a key hire here going forward, especially too now, you know, with Clay Helton. And it's funny, a week ago, and I joke with Herbie about this, we were trying to pronounce the quarterback's name, the true freshman quarterback, and now by the end of the week, everybody's chanting MVP, MVP for Keaton Slovis after what he did against Stanford in the second half. And Clay, and there's now suddenly an opening here after you saw what happened to Washington this past weekend and 2 weeks ago to Oregon. And now suddenly you're like, okay, USC 2-0. What do we have? They got BYU this coming weekend. They got a brutal stretch in the next 5 weeks. But, I mean, Clay can finally turn things around with this young man, Slovis, and there is an opening for SC football, something that you talked about on your podcast where we've seen that drop off over the last 13 years after Vince Young scored that touchdown in the Rose Bowl. And after Pete left, the coaching hires and maybe giving jobs to coaches that were not ready for the spotlight of SC and the decision making all the way at the top.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, Lane Kiffin and Steve Sarkisian were Pete Carroll's right hand men on the offense, young guys that he gave a opportunity to, and then he left, and USC hired first Kiffin and then Sark, and neither one of them was ready for that job, and they flamed out. Clay Helton is the antithesis of Kiffin and Sark. He's a grounded guy. He's quiet. He's dogged, determined, but he hadn't won very much. You know, he had a great season where they won the Pac-12, and then they fell off the face of the earth. So now, as you point out, you know, 1 week, really one incredible half.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of football in early September, isn't it?
You know,
your emotions just whipsaw, you know. But who would have thought because I certainly didn't, that, you know, we'd be mid-September and Clay Helton would look like the stable one in the USC.
Go figure, right? Exactly. With an 18-year-old quarterback, right, who's a true freshman that enrolled early in January. I love the storyline, and to me, it's a fascinating thing. And I think you'd agree, especially when listening to your Down and Distance podcast this past week, I think you would agree. College football is great when the blue bloods play a big role, and USC is one of the blue bloods. When USC is relevant, like the Notre Dames and the Alabamas, the Oklahomas and the Penn States, it's great for college football.
Well, it is, and it's been that way throughout the history of the game. USC has been very good for a very long time, and you know, we saw that with the debut of our 150 greatest teams this week. You know, USC had two of the top four spots. There is an incredible legacy there. And we all recognize when those schools that you just listed, those programs, you know, when they're good, people flock to their televisions.
And that's a great segue. So thank you, Ivan, for that. And we had David Pollack on earlier on the podcast to get his opinions about this 150 greatest college football single season teams of all time, released by ESPN earlier this week. Panel of 150 media members, athletic administrators, former players and coaches, and there were 210 finalists initially identified by ESPN Stats and Info Group. By the way, maybe the most underrated group here at ESPN. They're the backbone to everything we do. You don't see their faces, but you certainly understand what they're saying because we are processing their content on the air. You brought up USC, and that 2004 USC team, a head coach by Pete Carroll, was number two. The number one team is the 1971 Nebraska team featuring Johnny Rogers. What was the process like in determining, you know, let's just go top 10 here, the top 10 in narrowing everything down?
Well, the way, rather than have everybody rank teams from 1 to 150, because that would just make your head hurt.
Yep.
We created there was a computer program where would randomly match one team against the other of these 210 candidates. And our voters, the 150 voters, all signed in and voted. And you might get 1971 Nebraska versus 2018 Clemson. You might get 1888 Yale versus 1946 Notre Dame. And you have to decide by your own criteria. We didn't want to legislate too much which one was the greater team. Now, obviously, a team of the modern day could line up under the modern rules and easily beat one of those old teams. Now, could they beat them under their rules? Do you want to look at it that way? Do you want to look at it as simply, was the margin of separation of that 1888 Yale team and everybody else greater than the 2018 team? You know, do you just look at them within their own sphere? We let everybody decide that on their own. And we got thousands and thousands of votes, which each team would come up for a vote on a computer screen, and that was either a win or a loss. And after that, it was just who had the best winning percentage.
Fascinating. I do like that over a list of, hey, let's just write down 1 through 150. And if you did that, I'd say they're not paying you enough, Ivan, to sort all of that out.
Yes.
But to me, it's also what's fresh in our minds, because I thought that 2018 Clemson team, which comes in ranked fifth, is a little overrated, if that's possible, when looking at a top 10 list of all time teams, considering that 2005 Texas team is sixth. And to me, a top three team of all time is that 2001 Miami team, and what Larry Coker built, or I should say Butch Davis built, and Larry Coker made sure to see the finish, which, what, 38 players on that roster were drafted by the NFL and 17 first round picks. It was so ridiculous how good that 2001 team is. And of course, I'm biased because I'm only 44, so I can't tell you about the 79 Alabama team with Bear Bryant because I was four years old. But
To me, it's just seeing 2018 Clemson at 5, two spots ahead of 2001 Miami. I found that fascinating.
Well, I was worried about recency bias, and I was really worried. So the fact that we had a team from 1971 come in first, and that went, okay, these people are paying attention. You know, it's not just the last thing that came across their nose. And I think there was some of that with Clemson being number 5. But on the other hand, you know, nobody in major college football had been 15-0 since the 1880s.
Fair point.
So, yeah, and I think that I think that appealed to the voters. And I would say the fact that what they did in the playoff, you know, beating Notre Dame and Alabama the way they beat them, each by 4 touchdowns, probably left a mark on the voters as well.
All right, you're kind of winning me over, especially how they dominated Alabama and how we viewed Alabama a year ago
exactly.
At this time and what Tua was doing and you know, how we were talking about this could be an all-time great team here and how they dismantled them in San Francisco, or at least in the Bay Area. Ivan, it was great. I love having you on this podcast here with us every single Wednesday. And don't forget to download Ivan's podcast, which is fantastic, the Down and Distance podcast. Before we let you go, what's the topic this week?
The two that dropped this week, one is the 1959 Oklahoma team and how they were, you know, that was the dynasty that at one point won 47 straight games, and it all came a cropper in a Chicago nightclub in 1959. And the culprit was fruit salad. And I'll let you listen to what that means. And the other one is there were two college football teams in Hawaii on December 7th, 1941, who had gone over to play the University of Hawaii. And all of a sudden, they're marooned there. And, you know, and they are within range of enemy bombs. And they are scared. And so we tell their story of how they got there and what happened to them once the war began and how they got back to the mainland.
Ivan, fantastic teases. And if you want to go back, of course, you could download all the Down and Distance podcasts. Trust me, it's fantastic listening. If you're a fan of college football, you want to make sure you want to check that out. Ivan, enjoy week 3. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Kevin.
I want to thank Ivan Maisel and David Pollack for joining us to get their thoughts on the weekend's biggest storylines. Also want to thank our sponsors, Allstate and Goodyear. Big thanks to our producer, Gabe Bassane. If you enjoyed this podcast and want more, all you have to do is subscribe to the College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollack. And of course, remember to rate and review. Much appreciated. Ahead on Friday, Pollack joins us to break down the week 3 schedule and take a closer look at rivalries as a player. Talk to you then.